Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Does black solidarity still make sense?
The Organization of Afro-American Unity shall include all people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere.
In the era of Obama, in the supposedly post-racial era, is there still a place for political unity amongst African Americans?
Or does black solidarity further entrench racial differences?
The purpose of our Organization of Afro-American Unity, to bring about the complete independence of people of African descent.
Is black solidarity still necessary to fight racial inequality?
Doesn't worrying about class solidarity make more sense?
We need to seek some allies among people who look something like we do.
Shouldn't we be moving beyond race entirely?
Our guest is Tommy Shelby, author of We Who Are Dark, Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that start at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken and I both teach philosophy.
Our topic this week, black solidarity.
Well, I have to admit, Ken, that part of me thinks that this topic is a bit, well, 20th century. When this country still suffered from rampant racism, black solidarity, people being hand in hand on the basis of their shared history, made sense. But now in the 21st century?
You're saying that racism is a thing of the past? Don't tell me, John. You've bought into that idea that we've in this post-racial age due to Obama and all that stuff.
No, racism isn't a thing of the past, but things have changed. I mean, Obama is black, and he is president. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, when I grew up, racism confronted black people at every turn. We really don't live in that country anymore.
I agree with you. Thank God for that. But there are still lots of things that impact the lives of black people disproportionately and negatively. I mean, our lousy schools, the flood of jobs from the urban core, and our out-of-control prison system. That's one of my big bugbears. Those are social ills, but they're racial ills, too. They're 21st century racial ills. And they give plenty of reasons for black people as black people to band together to fight them, I think.
Okay, but now what exactly is this thing, blackness, that you want black people to unite around?
Well, John, that's a complicated thing. I admit that. I mean, black people are a diverse lot. There's no one thing that black people all share that makes us all black people, not skin color, not genetic makeup, not cultural heritage, not political outlook. Black is what Wittgenstein used to call a family resemblance term, like the term game. Just as games come in all sizes and shapes and all different ways they're realized, well, with no common essence between them. The same with black people, no common essence between us.
Well, you're kind of making my point for me. Two arbitrary black people may have less in common with each other than either has with some random non-black person. Take two upper middle class professionals, one black, one white. Maybe you and one of your neighbors. Maybe they went to the same elite schools, maybe Notre Dame and the University of Chicago, and live in the same bucolic suburb, maybe Los Altos.
Okay.
They're likely to have more in common with each other than either has in common with an undereducated, underemployed, poor person, black or white.
Well, John, that may be true. I'm willing to grant that. But it just doesn't follow from that race doesn't matter. Look, race substantially affects your chances of ending up in that elite school in the first place. I'm not saying that race is the be-all, end-all of our social and political lives anymore like it was in the bad old days, but it still matters. And because race still matters, racial solidarity is still important and still valid.
So how far are you willing to go with it? Suppose our two upper middle class professionals each wants to ameliorate the plight of the poor. Would it be all right for each of them to have a special concern and solidarity with the members of their own race, rather than the poor in general?
Well, you know, that depends on whether you're talking black or white. I mean, I think it's okay for the privileged black guy to have special concern for the disadvantaged black people out of a sense of black solidarity. Actually, I think it's more than okay. I'd be bothered if he didn't feel a sense of racial solidarity.
And a white guy, same for him?
There, I have to admit, I find the very idea of white solidarity disturbing, even frightening.
Well, just to get clear here, I strongly suspect that Latino solidarity, Jewish solidarity, women's solidarity, Armenian solidarity, gay solidarity are all just fine with you. It's just poor, otherwise undistinguished white guys like me that don't get to have solidarity. What's the difference?
Well, that's the well-to-do black. Let's take the well-to-do black guy solidarity with his disadvantaged brother. That feels to me like a legitimate response to race-based oppression. But the privileged white guy solidarity with his less well-off brethren, you know what that feels like to me? It feels like an attempt to propagate white privilege downward.
But you're assuming that a disadvantaged white person is less disadvantaged than a disadvantaged black person.
Well, I am assuming that, John. That's because whatever other economic or social disadvantage the white person may have, there's one disadvantage he doesn't have. He doesn't have a racial disadvantage.
Well, it sounds like you believe that the white guy has some racial privilege. You really believe that some racial privilege is associated with being poor, white, and undereducated in America in the 21st century?
You know, now that you put it so sharply, I'm not sure I would say that. I wouldn't go that far. Look, guys, the global economy, I admit this, is grinding down our working class and our poor, black and white, without any regard to racial differences. In that struggle, we're all in it together.
If you think that way, shouldn't you be promoting economic equality and justice for all without regard to race?
I believe in those things. I'm not denying that. But why can't a concern for those things go along with black solidarity? Racial solidarity, I'm not saying it's the only thing we should care about. It's just one form of solidarity among others. But it is one form among others.
Yeah, it seems to me that makes things a lot more complicated. I mean, what happens when different forms of solidarity pull us in different directions? Which form of solidarity is more important than why?
Well, those are hard questions, John, and important questions. And to help us begin to find some answers, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to talk to some black people about what racial solidarity means in their own lives. She files this report.
Martin Luther King Day at Allen Temple Baptist Church. Reverend Daniel Buford had a message for the dozens of residents who turned out to clean up a blighted neighborhood in East Oakland.
What you see before you today, you would not have seen 50 years ago in the United States. We have an Asian woman that is a mayor of a major city. Amen. We have a congresswoman who is African American, who voted against the war in Iraq. We have a city council president that's an African American. So this is what Dr. King's dream was about. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, we have an African American president to give us his day off. So we have a lot to be thankful for.
Standing beside Reverend Buford was Congresswoman Barbara Lee.
Many of us believe that always was the way it is, and I always remind my younger brothers and sisters, my grandchildren, I couldn't go to public schools because I was black. I couldn't drink out of the water fountain unless it said colored only. I couldn't travel from Texas to California unless it was on the colored only train.
Lee's father was a lieutenant colonel in the Army. She says he served 25 years in two wars, and still she recalls being denied access to restaurants.
And I share this with you because we've come a long way. But you know what? What you're doing to do reminds us of how much further we have to go.
The congresswoman called on residents of this mostly black neighborhood troubled by poverty and violence to help get the guns off the streets. And that raises the question, how important is ethnic solidarity in achieving these goals?
We still suffer from chains and images of psychological slavery. We may not be enslaved by chains anymore, but there's a psychology that keeps us in a prison cell.
Marcus Shelby is an educator, musician, and composer. He recently released Soul of the Movement, Meditations on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Shelby spent 4 years researching and traveling through the South, from Memphis to Birmingham, to really know the stories he vaguely learned about. Stories of the Little Rock Nine, of Emmett Till, and the Montgomery bus boycotts. Shelby says knowing history is crucial to understanding the present, and music is a major part of that.
What did keep black solidarity strong in many cases was the music, because the music spoke out against such nonsense. Whether it was spirituals or freedom songs like This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine, or whether it was a song like Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around. These songs gave a sense of strength and solidarity, and it rewrote what the image of black people should be like to combat racism, segregation, break the chains of slavery.
Shelby says black solidarity has been necessary historically, but these days it's the widening gap between rich and poor that he believes should unite people.
Solidarity has to be shared not only with just people who share the plight that you do, and that may be people who have the same skin color, but I think the income disparity, the lack of people who have a voice where these decisions are making, are just as critical.
If Americans can collectively decide to stamp out poverty-related social injustices, Shelby says we'd all be better off.
Because if you're poor, don't matter if you're black or white, you still have the thumb of our system on your neck.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. Gave us a sense of the many dimensions of black solidarity, I think. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're philosophizing about black solidarity. We're joined now by Tommy Shelby. He's a professor of philosophy and also of African and African American studies from Harvard University. And he's author of the very fine book, We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity. Tommy, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Tommy, over the years, I've read a number of books on black solidarity and known some of the people who wrote them, but I don't remember one that was so explicitly philosophical and offering a philosophical foundation as yours. What motivated you to want to offer a philosophical defense of black solidarity?
Well, I guess like a lot of blacks, I grew up with a kind of pre-reflective and implicit commitment to black solidarity. And when I was an undergraduate at Florida A&M University, a historically black college in Florida, I was introduced to Anthony Appiah's critiques of the idea of race and of racial solidarity. And I found those critiques really challenging. And at least for a while, I think I began to really doubt that you could really defend black solidarity. But my philosopher's disposition sort of, I guess, took over, and I began to think a bit more carefully, hopefully deeply, about just what black solidarity entailed and how it might be justified.
So let's start by getting a little clearer about what it is you're defending. What exactly do you mean by black solidarity?
Well, I think of black solidarity as a type of reciprocal ethical commitment amongst blacks to, you know, fight for justice for the group and to protect the group from harm. And you could think of this commitment as a kind of pledge or maybe a vow, a way of sincerely, you know, binding yourself to others in a cause.
Okay, so that seems, black solidarity is a form of solidarity, right? Because it seems to me that if you have solidarity with somebody, you stand together with them in virtue of something about you and they. I mean, maybe because you like them, maybe because you find them reasonable, maybe because they're your fellow human. But let's go back to the diversity of black people. What exactly does it, I mean, what does that, you worried about Anthony Appiah's worry about work about the consequences of Appiah's work about race and, you know, the emptiness of notions of race. I mean, what kind of notion of blackness do you have that says, okay, be solidarity with people like this, have solidarity with people like this? Well, what's the notion of blackness around which you want to understand solidarity?
Well, I think it's useful to make a distinction between what I call thin blackness and thick blackness. You know, thin blackness is, a kind of category within a social scheme of classification. So blacks are people with sub-Saharan ancestry who share certain visible and inherited physical traits. And this is a kind of social fact and one that happens to carry, in, at least in this country and many other places in the world, a kind of stigma. And we all know, you know, when you receive a form, what you're supposed to check off. They're ambiguous cases, but for the most part, I think people know whether the social classification fits them or it doesn't.
Really? It seems to me there are more and more ambiguous cases. I mean, our president, Barack Obama, he has a white parent and a black parent. He chooses, and I think, kind of society in some ways forces him to choose, that he's a black man rather than, say, a biracial man or a white man. I mean, is it really so clear what these ambiguous cases are? Where you should go with these increasing number of ambiguous cases?
Well, I think in the black case, it's pretty straightforward in that I think the one drop rule still reigns, at least implicitly. So if you're known to have recent black ancestors, then you're black. And I don't think that Obama is, I don't think he finds it particularly difficult to answer that question. He might feel it difficult to know how to position himself in relationship to whites, given that he has a white mother and other white ancestors. But he doesn't seem to have any particular difficulty understanding himself as black.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about black solidarity with Tommy Shelby from Harvard University.
Black people are a diverse lot. Whether we're speaking biologically or culturally, there's no one thing that blackness consists of, no one thing that a variety of black identities all share. Given that, does black solidarity really, can it be justified?
The unity and diversity of blackness, when Philosophy Talk continues.
The godfather of soul, the hardest working man in show business, Mr. Dynamite. All phrases that might be used to identify my partner in philosophy, Ken Taylor. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and I'm proud to be compared to the great James Brown, and we're talking about black solidarity.
Our guest is Tommy Shelby from Harvard University, author of We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity.
So, Tommy, you made this distinction between thin and thick conceptions of blackness. I take that partly has to do, I mean, the thin conception of blackness, I wonder how much content it really, really has. I mean, you know, many people have argued, or some people have argued, that race is a nearly empty notion. It's got no basis in biology. Even if you say it's socially constructed, still there's a cultural and social and political and religious diversity among black people, especially if we do as you do and say the one drop rule still lives. That means that Obama's grand, if no descendant of Obama's ever marries another black person ever again, his descendants will all be black. One quarter, one half, one eighth, down to, they'll all still be black. That makes black really, really diverse. Given that, what's the justification of any form of racial solidarity? In a sense, there's nothing to justify if race is so empty and tenuous.
Well, I don't think that thin blackness is what does the justifying work here, right? I mean, it's just a way of identifying who is a potential member of the solidarity group, right? I mean, those vulnerable to various forms of mistreatment because that social classification applies to them. And so, yes, in that sense, I mean, insofar as being black in that thin sense continues, you know, generations down the line, then there will still be a need for black solidarity because such people, so classified, will be vulnerable to these forms of mistreatment, and it might make sense for them to ally themselves in order to put up some form of resistance, if not overcome that type of social injustice.
Well, I'm inclined to give you blackness. I think it's a complicated but, you know, pretty clear phenomenon, even if it's maybe in the future won't be. But black solidarity. Now, are you like Ken? Are you going to draw the line between black solidarity and white solidarity? When we talk about white solidarity, we might think of Pat Buchanan or Rush Limbaugh, but but it seems to me that there might be more humane kinds of white solidarity, just people who are white and are kind of, you know, impressed by the complicated conditions that growing up white have put on the children of today's age and kind of might make that their mission in life. Is white solidarity a verboten idea for you?
I'm not. I don't think that you can rule it out of hand. I mean, I think that there would be plenty of reasons to be suspicious of it and to wonder about the motivation behind it. But you could imagine a situation where, say, poor rural whites weren't getting any attention by government, and other groups that have forms of solidarity seem to have no sympathy for those poor whites. And in light of that, you might think they might want to ally themselves in ways to, you know, advocate for programs that might help them or initiatives that might help them. They might also, of course, you could have solidarity amongst whites who, and I think you have this amongst some whites, who think that it's important to, you know, root out the various forms of racism and nativism and intolerance that might be prevalent amongst whites themselves.
So that's white solidarity is a purifying, not racial purity, but morally purifying, a morally cleansing kind of movement. We band together to cleanse ourselves of our morally problematic supremacist attitudes. Is that the kind of attitude? Is that the kind of thing you're thinking of?
Well, I mean, that's one form it might take. I think it could take other forms. I mean, you're going to justify particular forms of solidarity depending on the values and goals that are the real basis of the justification. It's that joint commitment to certain values and goals that ultimately sort of grounds the solidarity. So if that joint commitment is to, you know, white supremacy, you know, or to goals of, you know, maintaining white dominance, then obviously it's not justified. But you could imagine goals and values that whites might commit themselves to that are not so problematic.
So, but see, here's just a little bit of a worry here. Solidarity with a distinctive group is kind of separating. It's saying that I have special attitudes, special relations, special bonds with that group that I don't have to the, let's call it the out group. I have special bonds to poor black people or just any black people that I don't have to white people in general. Why isn't the deepest, most compelling form of solidarity human solidarity? I mean, why single out, right? So the call of the civil rights movements was we want our citizens to be treated as citizens, as equal citizens among other citizens, right? So why not that ideal?
Well, if it were available and politically effective, I'd prefer it. But I think that solidarity is a kind of pragmatic response to the political difficulties on the ground, opposition from various groups, apathy on the part of certain people, indifference, and sometimes hostility. So partly what black solidarity is a response to is that sense that we have, that amongst blacks, we have the deepest investment and commitment to racial justice. And I think if we felt like that sort of commitment was very widespread, sure, why not reach for that, those broader forms of solidarity? But of course, the two are not, I don't think, incompatible in any case.
Well, I mean, maybe I differ from Ken here, but I think narrow forms of solidarity make perfectly good sense because we each have certain experiences that depend a lot on various facts about us. And reaching out to people with similar experiences and helping them in various ways, to me, makes sense. But all these kinds of solidarity should as you suggest about white solidarity, but not be committed to really vile goals. I mean, suppose Warren Buffett is really concerned about the particular problems that rich people have, not in, you know, in that, you know, their BMWs break down more often than they should, but that he just knows that being rich presents certain problems and that to feel good about yourself, to do the right thing, to not completely get involved in unworthy things isn't good. So he makes it his mission to kind of work to help people like himself. Now, I mean, is that so crazy? I mean, so I guess my question is, you're justifying black solidarity. Is it a portable justification? Will it work with all these narrow forms of solidarity as long as they're not just committed to promoting vile things like injustice?
Well, I think you want to distinguish between sort of affinity groups or interest groups from solidarity groups. I think of solidarity as a kind of political value. So it's an ethical commitment rooted in certain political values, in particular justice. So in some cases, the case you gave, you can imagine people who have certain shared interests and, you know, a certain affinity for one another and a sense that others might not understand things that they're going through, and so they have bonds and act on the basis of those bonds. But I don't think of that as solidarity in a relevant sense, because what I have in mind when I think of black solidarity is a political commitment that's aligned with a justice agenda, and it's sort of hard to see what that would look like in the case of Buffett and other billionaires.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing black solidarity, and we have Mark from Oakland on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Hi. So I'm a physician, and I like work in both underserved communities and private practice. Just comment is the basis of the conversation comes from where racism begins, which was a philosophical construct that whites were superior than blacks.
Okay. Is that the end of your comment? I'm not quite sure what you want to. Is there a question there?
I guess I want you to comment on, like, why do whites consider themselves better than blacks? Why? I mean, where did that? Where's the origin of the need for blacks to come together and have solidarity?
Okay, thanks for the question, Mark. Tommy, you want to tackle that one?
Oh, that's a big question. I mean, I assume. I mean, my basic take on that is that the idea of white superiority is part of a rationalization on the part of Europeans, people of European descent, for various land and labor and resource grabs that emerge in the modern era. And so it makes a lot of sense to, as a way of trying to justify exploitation of other people's labor and land and resources, to say that in some sense you have a right to rule over them because they're incapable of ruling themselves.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think the caller asked a good question, and there's a historical answer. You find even really intelligent people like David Hume harboring stupid views, stupid because they were uninformed about the racial superiority of whites, and even Thomas Jefferson, who had lots of reasons to rise above them, never quite got beyond them, I don't think. I want to ask a different question, though. I want to give you a kind of a challenging case. Now, you teach at an elite institution, Harvard University, maybe the most elite of the elite. Now, my understanding is that to be accepted to Harvard as an undergraduate, and the thing is true of most of the elite universities, if we correct for SAT scores, take three students with the same SAT score, one black, one white, and one Asian, the black will have the best chance of getting in, the white the next best chance of getting in, and the Asian the worst chance. How should blacks who are part of the Black Solidarity Movement feel about that if their main aim is justice? Should they be arguing that that shouldn't happen, or should they be seeing some basis for that injustice?
I think once you get down to the level of very specific policies, blacks are going to disagree, and that's going to be true of, when you're thinking we have broad goals that might be committed to, like racial justice, but there's going to be much disagreement about exactly how to implement that and, what policies are going to best achieve it, which ones are permissible, and so on. And I think affirmative action is one of those things where blacks do disagree over whether it's a good idea, whether it's wise, and indeed whether it's permissible. I mean, I have my own views about that, but I don't think that is a litmus test for black solidarity.
Let me ask you a really quick question. You're very pragmatic about black solidarity, and you said it's a political commitment. But, I could think that it's a kind of more deeply moral commitment, the way that my solidarity with the members of my family is not just a political strategy, but it's something that some people think is intrinsically morally demanding on me, these intimate relationships. I mean, I think there are people who think, well, race is like that. Race is a kind of bond that bonds you together, not just as a political strategy, but out of some kind, it has a deeper normative significance than that. Because the strategy thing could just be temporary and for this purpose in this context. I mean, what do you say about that?
Well, it's certainly true that I think historically in the black nationalist tradition, in its classical forms, there was a sense that, black solidarity forever, black solidarity
right.
is, and because it's partly rooted in the sense of a shared racial identity, where that is a thick notion, if you like, pregnant with normative implications and the like. I think it's part of what Anthony Appiah's work and others' work have shown. I think it's very difficult to get much in the way of ethical commitment out of the race concept itself. And so I've been very skeptical that you can pull that kind of thing off, which is not to say that there can't be feelings of affection and affinity, a sense of community, which I think is distinct from or separate from solidarity, though could support it. There could be a sense of community amongst blacks because of a shared history and certain common problems. And even thinking about the incredible legacy of black collective struggles to bring about justice as a way of thinking of yourself as connected to others. And that can be something that's, I think, intrinsically valuable. But it doesn't depend on any kind of deep, you know, racial right. essence that binds us together.
Okay, so let me get this clear. So you know, you're not a believer in racial essence and all that, and sort of thickly shared, thick racial identities that are shared. If I were to ask, what is blackness for you? It's this multiplicity thing, but still, it's got a normative significance, kind of because of the situation in which we live now. But one could imagine getting beyond that. Is that right?
Yes, I'd like to think that we could. So, I mean, in some ways, I think of Black solidarity as analogous to the way, say, Karl Marx would have thought of class solidarity. There are differences. But one thing they have in common is the sense that the reason for this kind of bonding together is to secure full freedom and thereby to make such solidarity unnecessary. So it's a kind of self-transcending project.
But if I think of myself, suppose I'm, you know, like the Afrocentric movement, suppose if I think of Black identity as a thick identity and essential to who I am in the world kind of thing, would you say that I have a kind of false consciousness or something like that?
I think it would depend on how you understood it. I mean, there are a number of Blacks who have a very strong sense of their identity is rooted in a shared culture, and insofar as there is such a shared culture, I think to some extent there is, at least amongst African Americans, more narrowly Black culture. That kind of commitment could surely outlast what I'm here calling Black political solidarity, but it wouldn't be politicized in the relevant sense. I mean, it would be rooted in a sense of we share a cultural identity, a set of practices and rituals and ideals that we want to see perpetuated, and we thereby collectively work to see that happen. But I don't see that as a form of political solidarity, because it's not.
I take your point.
You're fundamental.
I take your point. It's a good point. It's an important point. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Black solidarity with Tommy Shelby, author of We Who Are Dark.
In our final segment, we'll ask whether Black solidarity is going to be with us forever, or will there come a post-racial age when Black solidarity will just wither away?
Toward a post-racial age? When Philosophy Talk continues.
Just because you're proud to be Black, does that mean you're in solidarity with all the other Black folk? I'm John Perry, and we're talking about Black solidarity on Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Tommy Shelby from Harvard University.
Tommy, in my own case, I have 10 grandchildren, all of whom are teenagers or older. About half are Black and half are white. I would be quite disappointed if my Black grandchildren didn't feel what you call solidarity with others who've had the Black experience. But I'm not so sure about the solidarity part. I mean, I want them to be interested in the plight of Blacks, interested in justice for Blacks, sensitive to the history of Blacks. But I want that on the part of my white grandchildren, too. I think they've all had the experience of living with their brothers and sisters and cousins. And they should be similarly sensitive. So is the solidarity, that's what I question, not the commitment to redressing the justice for a group that's really been had hard times in America and continues to do so. But why solidarity? Why not just all of us should be concerned about this?
Yeah, I think we all should be concerned about this. I mean, I think that the reason groups form solidarity is to try to make that ethical commitment to something, with something that's politically powerful, something that can a form of collective action that can bring about changes, and if not change, at least a kind of group self-protection and a form of mutual concern within the group, just to help it, get by and survive or live to fight another day. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with, in fact, I think that's the fundamental grounding of solidarity is a universal, if you like, impartial ethical commitment. But that kind of more partial commitment, I think, is partly there because of the need for loyalty and in a struggle again when there's adversity, and the need for a kind of trust, which is just more easily formed amongst people who have, if you like, a skin in the game, you know, that is, who have a kind of a personal stake.
But Tommy, John is giving you a case from his family. You need to know his family. It's a very diverse family, right? He's got, as he said, how many black grandchildren?
Six black, four white.
You know, because his children, you know, they were into miscegenation. Kind of. And he adopted a black son.
He has
a black son. So these folks have lived together. I mean, one of the things you might think about the source of black solidarity is black people living together, as it were, a kind of collective life. But if people's lives are enmeshed in these complicated ways, that makes sort of the talk about a black community versus this community harder and harder. And if you look at the number of interracial marriages and the number of children, you know, when the Census Bureau gave you that option of checking more, see, that's the wave of the future, it seems, sort of less racial separation and more kind of race mixing, as it were. So, I mean, what does it mean in a family like John's, or a society like some people think we're becoming, some people think we've already become such a society?
Well, at least in California now, maybe Tommy's kind of got an East Coast bias here. Florida, Harvard, all those East Coast segregated places.
Yeah, so what do you think?
I mean, I think those are the most challenging cases where, I mean, I noticed from my own experience as well, when there are intimate bonds between blacks and non-blacks, say in the case of a family, how to think about the implications of solidarity in that case. But I think even, you know, in families like John's, like my own, where there are black and white members, people can understand the difference between the personal experience of being vulnerable to anti-black racism and stereotypes and stigma, being directly affected and being indirectly affected, and the way in which that can affect how you see things, how you carry the burden, and the sense of implicit trust that you will have toward others who don't share those kinds of intimate bonds with, who you know also have those kinds of experiences.
So it's complicated. So let me ask you. So I want you to be a prognosticator of the future of America. You know, I know you're a philosopher, not a social prognosticator, but put on your social prognosticator. So some people, you know, I mean, maybe it's because I live in California and I watch my biracial son growing up in a neighborhood with all kinds of people of all sorts. And, you know, they're not that hung up in race. At least they're not as hung up in race as we were when I was his age. I mean, we were hung up in race. There's no two ways about it. Either for good, sometimes for ill. Are we moving into a society in which just race withers away? I mean, is that a realistic possibility, or is that just some kind of distant conceptual possibility that's not really open to us?
I'd like to think that it's not around the corner, but I mean, I'd like to think that it's something that at least future generations will see. I mean, I think one of the things you find is, even though there is more, in fact, interracial marriages and interracial reproduction, if you like, it's pretty limited when you think about the country as a whole. I mean, we happen to be living, I mean, you're living in the Bay Area, I'm in Cambridge. I mean, the rest of the country is really not like these places.
So let me ask you, I agree. So you're living in Cambridge, and this reminds me of something about, so go back to our opening. You said the privileged white guy and the privileged black guy. I remember this incident with your colleague, Skip Gates, being stopped by the police getting into his own house, right? Mm-hmm. Now, you might think, well, you know, racism affects lower classes, working class, but Harvard professors? Do you think racism still affects every strata of black American life in the way that it did when my father was a young man? Because I'm trying to figure out how urgent in our current social context is black solidarity by your lights.
I think in some ways, I think this may surprise you, but in some ways I think of it as not nearly as urgent as other forms of solidarity, or there's ways in which I don't think problems of race are as urgent as, say, some problems of economic justice, as some of them in the earlier segment that you did. But I still think that it matters, and it's something that we have to be vigilant about. I mean, it can't solve all our problems. It's meant to, I think, attack a particular set of problems that we've that continue and that are we've inherited historically, but we shouldn't think of it as a solution to all the most urgent problems that we face.
Lauren in San Francisco wants to join this conversation. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lauren.
Thanks for having me. So I'm just listening to the discussion, and it seems the question of race is very complicated, and I'm wondering, why should we focus so much on race now when economic disparity seems to be more crucial? And should we not be more focused on that rather than thinking about it in terms of race?
That's a challenge to you, Tommy, although I think you partly answered that. Thanks for the question, Lauren.
Well, I'd like to think that, you know, economic justice and racial justice are compatible in both things we can, you know, we can be concerned with both. I mean, some things are more urgent because of the practical effects it has on people's lives, and you have to give more attention to them. But I think as if you think, as I do, that racial discrimination does affect black life chances, that past racial injustice still imposes current burdens, and you don't think that all the racial disparities and disadvantages that exist are due to, say, blacks' own failings, then it's something to you have to give attention to. It's something that one has to be concerned with. And even though in America there's a kind of, if you like, race fatigue, and people are kind of tired of thinking about it and like to get past it, that's not the best way, I think, to bring about just conditions.
So let me ask you a question, Tommy, and for Ken, too. I just want your opinion from your perspectives. It seems to me, at least here in California, the biggest problem for black people is the prison system and a tremendous number of black men that end up in prison, so many that it actually affects significantly black women who are in spite of all the racial mixing that goes on in California, are still significantly undermated or something. I don't know quite what the word is. And the black prison population seems to me intrinsically connected to our drug laws. Now, I'm not sure where in the mix of that historic racism and the need for black solidarity gets a bite. Maybe it does, but does that problem, which seems to me the big problem, connect with this perspective at all?
I mean, I think the problem of, if you like, a kind of racialized mass incarceration, if you like, yeah, is a deep and difficult problem. It has many, the causes are quite complex, and it's related to the existence of ghettos across America's urban landscape, which I think is in ways the most urgent problem for blacks who have solidarity to be concerned about, is that connection between the ghettos and prisons and the fallout that exists as a result. But because the causes are so complex, it's not the kind of thing that I think that blacks can think of as their problem. It requires a much more concerted interracial effort to be able to deal with it.
But still, it seems to me if the resources of black people across the country, which are not inconsiderable, I mean, black congressmen and many black leaders at lower levels of government, would really focus on saying, look, we got to deal with the drug laws. Our big problem isn't the deficit. The big problem is the drug laws.
Well,
and nobody ever mentions
them. Well, I said at the opening, one of my big bugbears, one of the big, huge racial problems is our insane prison system. It has disproportionate effects. It affects lots of people. But it's a huge, insane thing. I agree with you. The problems are complicated. But my thought is address that. Whether out of black solidarity or not, just out of human decency and wanting not to waste our human resources. And this is a hugely different society. What do you think, Tom?
I entirely agree. I mean, I think it's a huge problem. And it's the kind of, I mean, the drug laws are very complex because there are a lot of people who, you know, have an investment in keeping things the way that they are. So it will require quite an effort to roll that back. And even amongst Congress, when they're surveyed about the matter, when the issue comes up, there's a great reluctance to make a change there.
Do you think that reluctance is at all residual racism, or is it something else? I mean, is there residual racism driving this system?
Even in those communities, though, I mean, there are lots of blacks and Latinos who feel like if you didn't have these laws, things would be worse for them. Because I think they fear gang violence and the role of gangs in these poor and underserved communities. And they worry about their children being brought into them or pulled into these kinds of organizations. And I think that they feel like having police presence and bearing down on those who participate in the illicit drug trade gives them a better chance. I mean, that's the kind of thing, that's a concrete thing that people are going to disagree about, and we have to debate it openly.
Tommy, that's a deep and important and hard point. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about this. It's been an enlightening subject about We Who Are Dark, and I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Tommy Shelby. He's a professor of philosophy and African and African American studies at Harvard University, and he's author of the very fine book, We Who Are Dark, The Philosophical Foundations of Black Solidarity. So, John, are you enlightened today on our thoughts about darkness?
Well, yes, I think I'm enlightened. You know, Ken, when you're old, like I am, pushing 70, complacency because of the progress that's been made is a danger. And I admit, I fall prey to that. I think back to the 60s at UCLA when we were just getting started in the idea of having philosophy and black literature, having philosophy, having black people in philosophy departments, that was important. We got the course started. We hired Angela Davis, then Reagan fired her. Now she's a professor at UC Santa Cruz. Tommy Shelby's at Harvard. And you, Ken, and the interesting thing about you is you're a philosopher of language. You don't really specialize in racial issues. You're an extremely distinguished professor at Stanford.
Well,
so I feel pretty good about where we've gotten.
On that note of hope, you know, I'll say this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow us on Twitter and find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
And you can go to our website, philosophytalk.org. There you'll be able to sign up to get a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk. Now, for an unaffiliated take on black solidarity, let's check with the singular Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I live in a black neighborhood. I'd say 40% black, 40% white hipsters, and the remaining 20 divided among Latinos and, well, me. The young black men I see every day in front of my house don't talk about politics or race much. They have their 40s and their blunts, and they vary in population from 2 to 10. Their daily conversation is generally about football, basketball, and the vagaries of the music industry. Several of them are hip-hop artists. Besides the lads on the street, there are the retired lady and her son down the block who are mainly into gardening. There is the woman across the street, a retired police dispatcher, who gets along well with the noisy young men, yet does not hesitate to call the police if they get too loud after 10 p.m. There's the guy across the street on the other side who works as a security guard, but is also a landlord, renting the big house in front to hipsters while he lives in back in a bungalow. As far as I've seen, he never interacts with the other black people on the block. So what does that tell me about the so-called black community? It makes me wonder, where do Herman Cain, say, and Jesse Jackson and Snoop Dogg find common ground? There's the color of the skin, certainly, but I'm of the opinion that there is no such thing as race. It only exists as an aspect of the troubled and delusional history of the world. Race is a myth, like free market capitalism, social Darwinism, or communism, that have had and still have a lasting and evil effect on social relationships. Longtime race and class alarmist Patrick Buchanan has a new book out called Suicide of a Superpower. What's it about? Well, white people are doomed as empire caregivers, apparently. Here's the taste. Quote, ethnomasochism, the taking of pleasure in the dispossession of one's own ethnic group, is a disease of the heart that never afflicted the America of Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, or Dwight Eisenhower. It comes out of a belief system that provides a morphine drip for a people who have come to accept the inevitability of their departure from history, unquote. Well, here in the hood, I see my black neighbors every day with their kids, their extended families, their intoxicants, and their opinions. The hipsters are more vague. They come and go, vanishing into their houses or out to their little jobs, replacing each other on a monthly basis. And here I stand, watching it all, fully ready to accept my departure from history. Just so long as they don't have to have an opinion about football, I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.